Global Voice presents Voices. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Voices here on the Global Voice. This month, I'm talking to somebody who I'm sure as soon as you hear him, many of you will say, I've heard that voice before, and I've heard it lots. I know I've heard it on media programs. This time, I'm talking with none other than Jonathan Marks. Jonathan Marks, let's get it right. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You sound definitely English. Were you born in the UK?
Definitely, yes. I was born in Hertford.
Oh, right, okay.
Just north of London.
Yeah, indeed. And I take it you went to school up there. And did you go to university and things after that?
Yes, I started in... I moved with my parents from Hertford to Norwich, and went to school in Norwich and went to university in Durham.
Did you have any interest in radio then?
Yes, it actually started very early on, and I suppose it was triggered by an uncle of mine who was a radio ham, and I used to go and visit him when I was on a holiday to see my grandparents in South Wales. And I was fascinated by what he was able to do, and mainly fascinated by the equipment that he had, because, there was a sense of power, you know, having power supplies of 55,000 volts and that sort of stuff.
Glowing valves and lovely things like that.
And fair play, I mean, he used to build projects.
Mm-hmm.
Showed me basically how both valves worked, but also transistors. And there, I think, kindled the fascination for the technology side. And then we used to go up on the bands and listen to both ham radio operators. I frankly wasn't, although I took the ham license mm-hmm. later, I never really got into ham radio, simply because by that time I was already into broadcasting and 500 kilowatts was enough in terms of power.
You say you were already into broadcasting?
What happened was that I started shortwave listening in about 1969. And simply as a listener at home, I discovered all the mainly the propaganda stations, the ones coming from the East, and I got absolutely fascinated by working out not only what they were programming, most of which was pretty boring, but also why they were doing it and who they hoped to reach. So I suppose I was more interested in the social aspect and the content, rather than just purely the technology.
Yes, you're 5 and 9, on to the next one sort of thing.
That's right. And I suppose that's what really disappointed me about some of the stuff with ham radio. Having built all this equipment and doing all the tests, the conversation was pretty boring. Anyway, so I got fascinated by that. And I entered a contest in 1974 on what was then Austrian Radio's shortwave service and later became Radio Austria International.
Mm-hmm.
And they were running a contest called ORF Test 74, presented by a great guy called David Hermges.
Oh, I remember him. Yes, indeed.
Unfortunately, he's passed away now, but he really gave me my chance, my break in broadcasting, because I won the contest. I answered all the questions that they had, and the contest was basically the prize was 1 week in Vienna. So I went with my father in must have been September 74. Saw them working at the Austrian shortwave service was basically four people working in a wooden barracks in the Argentinerstrasse in Vienna. Fantastic place. Fantastic in the sense that at that time, if I wanted to get into broadcasting in the UK, then you know, you'd have to start as the tea boy and go up in a very
And it was very limited
way.
Anyway, wasn't it? Because there wasn't much going. If you didn't do the BBC, you didn't do anything unless it was Luxembourg, perhaps.
True, and living in Norwich at the time, the only possibility was to go and maybe contribute to a VHF opt-out program called, I think it was Roundabout East Anglia?
Right,
anyway,
yeah.
it was a VHF-only program that used to pop up in the mornings. So there wasn't much of a career prospect unless you moved somewhere else. And at that time, indeed, the broadcasting aspect became interesting. So having won this contest, I came back home and then basically went to university. And
To study what?
To study applied physics and chemistry.
Okay, yeah. Good for broadcasters.
before going, I decided to take a year off. So rather than going straight to university, I wrote to David Hermes and said, you know, do you need somebody to sweep the floor or do something in Austria? And if I were to turn up, is there enough work to keep me going? And he wrote back a sort of non-committal letter, but reading between the lines, I realized, okay, I'll take the risk. And it was a huge risk because I was mainly on the science side. And I remember my German master saying, well, I wouldn't think of a career in
German radio,
in German broadcasting. And of course, all the stuff at Austrian radio was in German. If you didn't speak German, you were finished. So I took a risk. I remember paying 29 quid for a single trip to Austria on the train. And I remember my father had friends in Austria who said they'd keep an eye open to make sure that I was okay, because I was only 18 at the time. And I had a fantastic 14 months working in Austria. Actually attached to the program Report from Austria. And David Hermes had a program called Austrian Shortwave Panorama, which was their quarter-hour program once a week on a Sunday, which used to look at broadcasting developments. And it was basically David's hobby horse program, because
mm-hmm.
He was fascinated with broadcasting too. So I helped him with that and learnt not only how to write scripts, and also that it was all about the why of broadcasting, not just the what and when. And also made friends with a great guy in Vienna called Wolf Harant. Wolf did the shortwave panorama program, Kurzwellen Panorama in mm-hmm. German.
Mm-hmm.
He's still very active in terms of that they're building a huge radio archive. I would argue the largest radio archive on the planet in a former warehouse in just outside Vienna
mm-hmm.
That's owned by the ORF. And they've got all sorts of collections of not only QSL cards but also tapes and memorabilia. It's absolutely fascinating. I've actually done a video interview with Wolf more recently, and it's actually on my website. So,
okay, what is the website if anyone wants to go and see it?
Well, you can find everything I do at jonathanmarks.com.
Uh-huh. Right.
And on the website you'll also find a link to a blog called Critical Distance, and that's where I write quite a bit about media, but also about other things as well. And I've also, we'll come to that maybe a little bit later,
uh-huh.
Also shared an archive of programs I made at a later stage for Radio Netherlands.
Right, yes, and we'll certainly come on to Radio Netherlands. So, okay, you spent a good time at ORF. What then?
Well, I came back and decided that I wanted to go to – I did want to complete my studies. So I went for 3 years to Durham University studying applied physics and chemistry. during which I realized that from a career point of view, I was committing financial suicide if I then wanted to go on and do, let's say, a PhD and then end up working for ICI in Teesside. And frankly, although I was fascinated by the chemistry side, I was not all that enawed by the maths and the mm-hmm. applied physics.
Yeah,
and in fact, I was more interested in the stories around science rather than maybe the process of discovery itself.
Right.
And that's why I thought, right, okay, my career path is in that direction. So I started getting involved with other radio stations on a freelance basis. I used to help out organizations like the European DX Council,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote and presented some stuff because I had a tape recorder. I had a UR tape recorder so I could record.
I still have one, would you believe?
Yeah, I've still got it too. I would never throw it away.
No, absolutely not.
Wow, it's a part of my life.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I made a few recordings. I also had a short stint at the BBC Monitoring Service.
Oh, in Caversham.
Yes. I got to know the chief engineer, Keith, I forget his last name, who was I used to meet him at European DX Council conferences because I was representing Austrian radio and he was representing the BBC, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an EDXE meeting in Brussels. And I was fascinated by the fact that he had a briefcase with a combination lock on it.
Right.
And I started thinking, I wonder. So I asked him, I said, I'd like to do a bet. I'll bet I can get into your briefcase. And he said, well, okay. I mean, this is in the bar after the... And so I said, fine, okay, let me have a go. So I tried all the BBC house frequencies. And sure enough, 12095 was the combination.
Oh, God
lock.
Bless it. Yes, I know, 12095. Oh, heavens above, yes. Okay, so when did you really get into broadcasting next then?
This is the summer of 1980. I was working at BBC Monitoring. I was doing some odds and ends for a program called World Radio Club on the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see that wasn't really going to end up being a full career. And at that point, the phone went, and I got a telephone call from Radio Nederland, Radio Netherlands in Hilversum.
Sadly, and
It started in a rather funny way because it rang up. There was a woman on the end of the line with a very English voice, and she said, please hang on for Ville.
Right.
Followed by a long pause, and then... Oh, where the hell is Ville? We'll call you back, right?
Yes.
All right. And this was okay, except that I was in a phone box because I had no mobile phone or anything like that. Mm. And they'd arranged to call me at a number, which actually was a phone box just outside BBC Monitoring. So I waited in this phone box, and about 10 minutes later it rang again. And it turned out that it was a call from a guy called Ville van der Vloot, who at that time was the head of the English department at Radio Netherlands. And they had a problem. And the problem was that their presenter for the DX Jukebox program, which was their media show at the time, had announced he was going to go back to South Africa, a guy called Fritz Greveling.
Oh, yes, right.
And so they were looking for somebody to replace him. And the question was that going to be me? So I said, fine, yes, that sounds very interesting. So they said, could you come over next Wednesday to talk about it? And I said, fine, okay. And I basically had to go and buy myself an airline ticket, which I'd never done before. and wrote a check, and they said we'll pay you for the trip. That's fine. We'll reimburse you for your expenses. Mm-hmm. I said fine, and I wrote a check for I forget what it was, but knowing that I had to put the funds back in within 3 days, otherwise I'd be in serious trouble.
Right. Yes.
But it all worked out. I went to Hilversum, and it was quite clear that it was a good match there. A great team of people. The English department at that time was about 20, 22 people, because it did both news and current affairs as well as feature programs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in a period of change for Radio Netherlands. They'd moved away from just doing music programs and were now doing more feature materials, especially documentaries. And what I liked about both Austria and Radio Netherlands was the fact that because they were small teams, you basically learnt to do everything yourself.
And did you have a free hand with a media network when you got onto that? Did you have a completely free hand to bring in whatever you wanted in terms of the items?
Oh, completely free hand. I mean, when I arrived, and this was August of 1980, they put me on the air straight away because, they were short-staffed. I think there was about a flu going around. And I remember Jerry Kahn, who'd taken over basically to sort of keep the seat warm, basically said, you know, do you know what you're doing? And I said, well, I think I do. He said, well, it's all yours.
Oh, yes. Into
so
the deep end.
What I did was rather than the program in those days was mainly a mix of music. The idea was DX Jukebox, it says in the title, mm-hmm. was that it's a mix of music and technical information. And they thought that this was a way of attracting listeners because many people, especially in those days, had radio as a hobby. And what I wanted to do was to say, okay, I don't think people are tuning into shortwave radio to listen to the music. We're seeing the growth of FM, so that's going to kill the music aspect and the entertainment aspect. We have to entertain and inform in a different way. And maybe we can find a niche by indeed retaining the technical aspects, because just as today, there's a market for people who are fascinated by technology and its progress and what it's doing to the world.
Mm.
But at the same time, there were also, I thought, incredible stories, which I'd started researching when I was at Austrian Radio, about why various countries thought it was necessary to talk to other countries. So the whole fascination of broadcasting and, I suppose, propaganda.
I was going to say, in those days, it was hugely propaganda, wasn't it, in many instances?
Oh, yes. And that's why, looking back on it, the editorial freedom that we had at Radio Netherlands was actually, I would say, quite unique. At a later stage, I became program director of Radio Netherlands. And when I was talking to colleagues at other international broadcasting stations, it was indeed unique that they had appointed basically the head of content, and that person did not have a Dutch passport. It was a European passport, but it wasn't a Dutch passport.
Now, you were program director, what, of the whole of Radio Nederland, or were you just of the English service?
No, that's the whole lot. What happened was that I started as a program producer in 1980, and in about 1990, became head of the English department, and let's say coordinator of the English department, and then jumped because of personnel changes to become deputy program director in 1991. And I was program director, basically editor in chief of the operation from 1992 till 2003.
So when not only did you have to learn German for ORF, but you had to learn Dutch for Radio Nederland as well.
I did indeed. And I think it's quite important too. I mean, yes, you can quite happily survive in the Netherlands without speaking a word of Dutch, but you won't make any friends. And I do believe that, you know, if you're trying to work out what's happening around you, if you don't speak the local language, then it's very difficult.
Yeah.
You miss the nuances. And I think that's important, especially if you're trying to share cultures with different parts of the world. So although I don't write Dutch, yeah, I speak Dutch fluently enough to be able to have an argument with a Dutch journalist and say that's a brilliant idea, but we won't be doing it for the following three reasons.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So, okay, that came to an end because didn't Danny Sennett take it from there in terms of Media Network?
Yes. What we did, Andy came over from the World Radio TV Handbook, I think in about 1997. He was the editor of the World Radio TV Handbook and left. He was living in the Netherlands by that time. He'd moved from Denmark and was a regular contributor to the program. He used to come down on a Wednesday evening when we'd record the show. He took it over and turned it into, by that time, we were already running a web page because we actually had a web presence as early as 1994. And what I decided to do, A, because my job function was changing, actually becoming more intense, in 2000, when my co-host, Diana Janser, when she decided to go and work for Forrester Research, I decided now was a good time to go out on with a bang, as it were, rather than with a whimper. Mm-hmm. So I made the rather strange decision for some people to basically take out the show off the air.
Yeah, well, yes, okay, strange decision, as you say. But so what did you do then?
I worked for another 2 years for Radio Netherlands, looking at I was actually their creative director. In other words, at a radio station that size, of about 300 people, the position of editor-in-chief actually has to be two people. You have to have a director of today, busy with today's deadlines, as it were, and you also need a director of tomorrow, looking at strategies and what sort of programs are we going to be making 3 to 5 years from now.
And when did it come up that things were not looking good for Radio Nederland in terms of budgets and what have you? Were you there when that happened?
Oh, that's always been the case.
Right.
In the sense that international broadcasting is always always a challenge, and especially in the Netherlands, because the way it's financed, what happens is that money from the license fee, or what was the license fee in those days, and money that comes in from commercials, because public radio and television do carry commercial blocks, they put that together in one fund, and before they give that to the domestic broadcasters, there are two deductions. One of them was Radio Nederland Wereldomroep, the external service, mm-hmm. and the other one was the orchestras. And, of course, that meant to say that if the domestic broadcasters could find a way of reducing your budget, that was more for them.
Of course, yeah.
And so that meant to say you were always in a position of defending. In a medium which is actually rather difficult to defend because it's very difficult to prove that it has an effect. Yes, you can talk about letters. Yes, you can talk about reactions. But in this particular area, I mean, the sort of reactions that you get on social media certainly didn't come into a broadcasting station like Radio Netherlands.
No, of course
you have
not.
The so-called 10-day delay when you say something on the radio, and then 10 days later, people would complain about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the letters would come in.
Jonathan, we're getting near to time, but I would dearly love your views on the current and future state of shortwave radio. Do you think it has a reason for existence?
To be honest, no. I would separate shortwave radio from international broadcasting, because I think there's a huge need for communication and especially programming across borders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think there have been various windows where shortwave has tried to say, indeed, it has a future. I mean, initially it was trying to say, can we operate more efficiently by switching to single sideband? Can we digitize with DRM? And I was one of the people involved in the early stages of those type of experiments in 1996. And I think the problem now is that those windows have closed, and that if you look at the impact of other media distributed through the web, that means to say that for most target areas, shortwave is only a medium of last resort. I did a count the other day and discovered that, you know, about 8 countries in the world still you'll find shortwave being used as a main form of distribution. I think of Somalia, I think of Sudan, places like that.
Because that's the argument, isn't it? The argument is they haven't got the infrastructure with the internet to make it viable, but that's going to happen, surely.
Eventually, but I mean, that really depends on the politics. I think what's happened is that the broadcasting model is going away and it's turning into an access model. In other words, what people say is that an organization like a Deutsche Welle or a Radio Netherlands or a BBC World Service actually provides access to relevant information in languages that the audience can understand. And if it's not possible through, let's say, through the web, then indeed there may be an argument for saying, okay, we will push that information over a border by means of a transmitter. And the other thing, too, is that the audio quality has changed. What used to sound good on a shortwave radio now sounds pretty mediocre and dull and boring.
To say the least.
Yeah, I'm absolutely. So pleased that I recorded the programs, the Media Network program, in stereo and with high quality, and I also kept the tapes.
What's Jonathan Marks going to be doing in the next few years, you reckon?
I'm basically now a digital storyteller. I'm helping companies, and especially young companies and disruptive companies, tell their story. So I'm still fascinated and curious about especially technology. I'm doing some work at the moment with the high-tech campus in Eindhoven, which is actually the former Philips NatLab,
mm-hmm.
and basically helping young companies build their story, make the best use of both traditional media but also social media in getting those stories out, which isn't bad
that
for something that's 25 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so I thought, well, maybe I can, indeed, using the equipment that I've got here, certainly start with a podcast. And I think mix what we've learned in the past with where we're going in the future. What I see at the moment is that radio is at a crossroad.
Yeah.
Radio is coming to a crossroads. I think we're seeing the end of the radio dial, as it were.
Yeah, and the digital stuff. Yeah, not only is it coming to a crossroads, but our program is coming to an end, I'm afraid.
Okay.
I have enjoyed it immensely, Jonathan. Thank you ever so much for being our guest on Voices this month. You've been listening to Voices, and I've been speaking to Jonathan Marks, a voice many of you will know well. I'm Chrissy Cochran for The Global Voice, back next month with another poor guinea pig. Till then, I'm out of here. Bye.
Bye-bye. Voices.